Hello, nerds, and welcome to the Engadget podcast. I am your host, Terrence O'Brien. This is episode 27, American Tune. I am joined this week by Sherlyn Lowe.
Hi.
Hi. What's with the face?
Just because I don't like the title.
You don't like the title? You don't like Simon and Garfunkel?
I prefer Billy Joel.
We had this discussion beforehand. There will be no titling of episodes after Billy Joel songs. Sorry.
I don't understand why, but okay.
Also joining me this week is Dana Woolman.
Hello.
Hello.
My brother is essentially having a Billy Joel wedding, by the way. So you can come. Terrence can't come.
Yeah, he should.
We'll party together.
Wait. Yeah, let's do that. What is a Billy Joel wedding?
Well, you don't get to find out.
I just need to have this concept explained to
me.
The
fact that you don't know what it means, it means you can't go.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll just leave it at that. Yeah. All right, fine. I'm so confused right now. So, yeah, that's a great way to start the show, just with utter confusion. Let's go right into it, though, guys. Let's not waste any time. Let's go straight to Flame Wars. Start the same way we do every week. This is where we debate sort of the biggest stories of the week. Make your opening statement. You get 20 seconds. If you go overtime, I give you one of these. My favorite thing in the world.
If you go overtime, we'll give you Billy Joel.
Oh, yeah.
Fair enough.
I like that.
At the end of it, I will declare a winner. There's points there. We still don't have the leaderboard up. That's because I'm failing at my job. But we will do that. We will fix that. I promise. Soon. But let's start with the... So this is... I'm not going to lie. This is a story I'm not super up on. This was something that Sherlyn brought to my attention. The OnePlus 3T, which... I gather is a smartphone.
Good for you. Good for Step.
Yeah,
I like that.
It's almost as if he reads this site called Engadget.
Yeah.
Once in a while, I check it out.
Or
you know.
Curious about the brands.
Yeah. So the OnePlus 3T is a smartphone that apparently was artificially boosting its processor clock speeds during benchmark tests. So the question here, I guess, is. Is OnePlus cheating? Is this a dishonest way to go about benchmarking? Or is this sort of an acceptable way to measure performance, considering that, you know, modern processors get boosted for specific applications anyway? I am putting up our 20 seconds, and Dana, you go first.
I mean, yeah, technically it's cheating, but... everyone does it, really. I mean, Samsung and HTC have already been called out for similar kinds of manipulations. And ultimately, I guess what I'm arguing is this sort of practice is standard, and that's why reviews in general should not be founded so much on benchmarks anyway.
Fair enough. Your response, Sherlyn?
So because everyone else is doing it, to Dana's point, even if it is considered kind of unethical, it levels the playing field a little bit and gives you a more accurate idea of where they're standing. Plus, no one really uses benchmarks outside of reviewers anyway, so it's not affecting the daily performance.
I feel like what we're debating is like performance-enhancing drugs for athletes, except we're talking about something of much less consequence, which is imperceptible performance differences in smartphones.
Yeah.
I kind of feel like you both just made literally the same exact argument.
Which is my argument, I think. I mean, Dana was saying technically it is cheating, and I'm saying it's not just because the playing field. It's like a bell curve.
I guess I'm saying it's cheating, but it's not news.
Okay. And I'm saying it's not cheating because if everyone else is doing it, it's like grading on a bell curve.
So you think it's cheating and it doesn't matter. You don't think it's cheating and it still doesn't matter. That's literally the argument we're having.
Basically,
right now.
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
Which, but to Dana's point, it basically means that reviewers have to be a lot more careful when testing a phone and something that we...
I mean, yeah, it's like a pissing contest. Am I allowed to say that?
You can say whatever you want.
It is a pissing contest. It's a fight over small differences in numbers, but the actual real-world performance difference is pretty imperceptible. And we're talking about high-end phones across the board, many of which use the same processors and maybe the same amount of RAM. So what are we talking about, and why is that what we're focusing on, and why is this news, you know?
So Samsung's been caught before, as you said. Do they still do that, though, or is that something that they've done in the past but have stopped, like that practice has ended over there?
It's hard to say. They have said that they will stop, but...
I think, too, occasional swapping in of new trendy benchmarks and the retirement of older benchmarks sort of maybe creates new opportunities for gaming the system.
And I mean, the reason why it's news here also, I mean, OnePlus has such a huge fan base, and a lot of its, you know,
do
appeal.
They?
Yeah, OnePlus. Well, you just because you're a plebeian doesn't mean, you know, they don't have a huge.
I'm just trying to think of the last time I saw a OnePlus phone not at the Engadget office.
I've seen them out in the wild a lot, but that's because I hang out with cooler people than you do, so. But anyway, my point was that OnePlus actually came out, admitted that they did it, and they promised to not do it again.
That's the unusual part, isn't it?
Yeah, it's strange for them to just admit they did it anyway.
Well, Samsung copped to it, didn't they? They admitted it when they did it, and that was...
I think it took longer for them to own it.
That was 2014?
It. Yeah.
So...
That was more of a scandal back then, too, because that was that the first time they were using their own Exynos chip versus a Qualcomm? That might have been because that might have been the reason. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I mean,
I would be more offended, I think, if phone makers misled people about battery life.
Yeah,
especially like a phone like the 3T. I think we praised it for having long battery life. So if it turned out that that long battery life was really not that long in real world use, I'd be kind of pissed. But if you're saying it deserves a slightly lower score on a performance benchmark. Who cares?
Yeah. And it's, like you said, imperceptible.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Yeah. And nobody cares about benchmarks.
Well, I do. But,
do you?
It's vaguely.
What benchmarks do we still run on phones?
We use, I guess, some outdated ones, SunSpider.
I believe 3D Mark.
3D Mark is a graphics test that we use. We don't use Geekbench. We use Andy and 3E. Andy Bench. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of others. You don't even know what these mean, so why do you ask?
We just use the products.
I haven't written a smartphone review in like 3 years, so I don't.
And that's
know
why
anymore.
This doesn't make sense to you.
Yeah, this
maybe.
Is, I don't care.
But yeah, but regardless, I think the news point of it again is to remind us once again as reviewers how important it is to do your real world testing.
I literally feel like I could just. Flip a coin for whoever wins this, and that's literally what I'm going
to
do.
Considering I'm going to lose the next two, I feel like this
Dana
one
is... Dana is heads, Sherlyn is tails, and... Tails.
Yay!
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm not going to completely lose this one. So, okay, there we go.
Awesome. Yay. I'm so proud of you.
Yeah, I'm glad I flipped that coin well.
I also enjoy that I can just Google flip a coin and it does all the work
one.
For me.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the ACLU and Y Combinator. You don't look excited about this.
I'm not excited about Flame Wars today.
No?
Just
every day?
Yeah.
So this past weekend, the ACLU raised, what, $24 million? That's more than they generally raise in a year.
Yeah.
In a single weekend.
Yeah.
Pretty crazy. Like, it's a stunning amount of money. And to cope with this, they, for some reason, turned to Y Combinator as a way to help them manage all of this cash. Sherlyn, you're going to try and tell me why this partnership makes sense.
Y Combinator is a very successful venture capital company that, you know, is founded in a lot of tech startups or has helped a lot of tech startups grow. And, you know, for ACLU to join their school, you know, this is also one of the open available outlets for them to go turn to for help that won't really, that has track record. So that's it. I'm not
Dana.
All here today.
First of all, Y Combinator is an inappropriate choice because Y Combinator has not severed ties with funder Peter Thiel, who, of course, has strong ties to Trump, the Trump administration.
Which is the very reason that the ACLU has money in the first place.
Yes, but also, how can you be one of the largest and oldest nonprofits in this country and not be good at managing funds?
Oh, the ACLU?
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Yeah. They don't have... Because they're just not used to having this much funds.
Well, I think...
I think.
Do they not have people on their large staff who can advise on how to budget and spend money? Why do they need outside help if you're that big and old and experienced of an organization?
So what I thought was kind of interesting, though, is that they turned to Y Combinator. Not that the ACLU doesn't have people who can do this in-house necessarily, but there are other nonprofits who do exactly this sort of thing. So I found it weird that they would turn to Y Combinator as, like, you know, being that they're an accelerator and, you know, a venture capital firm and whatever else, rather than turning to other nonprofits whose sole job is to manage money for, you know, these kind of...
So some of the reasoning behind it, at least according to our article, is that, you know, Y Combinator, this will provide ACLU access to a lot of Y Combinator's network contacts and sources. So if ACLU needed more help, and again, a lot of the money that they got over the weekend was from the immigration ban, and a huge, you know, opponent of that ban has been the tech industry. So, I mean, this kind of lends ACLU the chance to get more money, because Y Combinator obviously knows where to get money from. So this might be like, I mean, that to me seems like at least kind of a parallel course. You know what I mean? Does that make sense? It's early in the morning.
It is early in the morning.
But that, I get what you're saying. That would suggest that ACLU's main focus going forward is to get even more money.
True.
The stated purpose, I think, was to figure out how to invest and spend that money.
I almost think that it's also to align itself with the big tech giants that would have the power to take down something like the immigration ban and more proposed executive orders.
My instinct would say, if you're as big of an organization as the ACLU, that got so much attention this past weekend and was able to get so much money in the first place, wouldn't you have a direct line to someone like Tim Cook or the CEO of any other big tech company? Would you even need Y Combinator as a middleman?
I feel like you would think they would have those direct connections, but I don't know. I mean, my idea of ACLU in the past wasn't that it's a big and old and established. I know it's old and has a long history, but from the emails I've been receiving over the past 2 years that I've been like a vague paying member of ACLU, the need and the thirst that comes across from these emails signals to me that they need more help than they've let on.
Well, I mean, any nonprofit, any charity is going to be like that. I mean,
I know.
If you donate to the Sierra Club, you're going to get the same, like, really desperate emails for money. If you accidentally signed up for Donald Trump's mailing list, you're going to get this. You're going to get this. No, that is not a thing I did on purpose.
Okay.
Yeah, no.
Terrence.
I emailed the campaign asking for comment on a story and once, they put me on their mailing list for donations.
Did they at least give you comment?
No. I just started receiving solicitations for donations.
Okay,
that's a thing that happened.
I mean, Dana is right. They should probably have some kind of connections.
I get what Y Combinator gets out of it. I think that they, this is my theory. I'm not going based on any quotes that have been printed in the press, but...
Why you gotta be fake news, Dana?
I'm fake news. They must know, right, that Peter Thiel is odious, and they must feel somewhat embarrassed by that connection. And having this partnership with the ACLU might help restore Y Combinator's reputation, or what they'd like for it to be its reputation as, if not a more progressive organization, a not fascist one.
Fair enough.
Right? So I kind of see what they get out of it.
Yeah.
I don't get what the ACLU gets out of it, though.
I mean, again, maybe the tech connections and the chance to... Again, this is a company, a venture capital company, that has proven it's able to make a lot of money, make the right investments. Mm-hmm. So probably that kind of a know-how, but there are other sources. You guys
like
are right.
Banks?
I think there's a lot more insidious choices out there than Y Combinator. I don't know.
No, I mean, I don't think the choice is like... I don't think there's anything insidious about Y Combinator or anything. It's just an odd decision. Like, that's just, to me, it just strikes me as strange more than anything else.
I think it's progressive.
Progressive. I'm going to give this one to Dana.
Sure, I expected that.
Yeah.
It's okay. This is right. That kind of a week. It's fine.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're split 1-1 right now.
Yeah. Well, I know what the result's going to be, so it's fine.
Let's end Flame Wars, though.
Oof, yeah.
With Adoptly.
F those guys.
So, Adoptly, for those who don't know, was a Kickstarter campaign for an app that was basically Tinder for babies. It offered you a selection of profiles for children who were up for adoption, and you could swipe right or left on them to decide.
And being a Kickstarter, you could donate real money to them.
Yeah. Mm. So, turns out, all a hoax, guys. It was a big joke.
It was an art project.
It was an art project.
Satire.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. That's what it was.
Yeah.
How do you even phrase this question? So, Dana, is this legitimately art, or is this simply an evil scheme?
I think it was definitely mean-spirited. I think that, I think for me the line was that they accepted real people's money, and that when reporters attempted to confront them about possibly being fake, they lied. So I think that they could have accomplished satirizing the sort of tone-deaf tech industry without taking real parents' money and without lying to the press.
In Just Under the Wire. Fill in.
Well, so based on the email that, you know, the people behind the Adoptly sent to Nate Ingram, they actually didn't think anyone would buy it in the beginning. So they don't think they had intention to take money for real and to make people sad. That's what they said. But art-wise, it's freedom of expression. I don't want to argue for them.
You don't have to. We can all just
I tried.
We can all just agree that it's a terrible thing. Everybody wins except Adoptly.
But I kind of want to explain a little bit after reading the email, the long email that they sent.
Okay.
Email which took no responsibility.
Yeah, they didn't, yeah.
So before you do read the email, I do want to say one thing, which is that even if they didn't think people were going to give them money and pay for the stupid thing, why would you start a Kickstarter? Why go to put together a fucking website, a joke app, and call it a day?
And if the intention was supposedly not to deceive people, because if they thought it was so ridiculous people wouldn't be deceived, why would you lie when people ask you
if it's... Yeah.
So that's why I think this goes beyond just satire. I think that this was a mean-spirited joke, and it was crappy of them to pawn off any responsibility when called on it.
So to explain a little bit, what they say was the reason they went to Kickstarter instead of anything else, they go, "We decided to launch it on Kickstarter rather than frame it as a company that was already funded or in beta as a way to add a tinge more believability that this was a group of naive entrepreneurs launching a misguided startup. It seemed to work." So, because it's a Kickstarter, you're more likely to believe that it's a real thing.
I mean, here's the thing.
That people dumb enough to start a Kickstarter project, came up with.
I could see it being a real thing without the need for a Kickstarter campaign. There are so many dumb, misguided products out there. I don't need your Kickstarter to convince me. You could have just released it and I would have been like, yeah, that seems like a dumb thing that somebody would do.
Yeah. I mean, also the fact that they were on Kickstarter didn't stop a lot of us from calling it a hoax or fake, right?
I mean, we were all pretty suspicious of it from moment one.
Yeah.
But they steadfastly claimed that it was a real thing for the first couple of weeks.
And kind of the way they framed the email to Nate was, "We liked how you handled things, and so we've decided to share the real story behind Adoptly with you below." And that, to me, was... where the mean-spirited gotcha.
Right, there's sorry we lied to you, sorry that we wasted your time.
Right.
Sorry that we deceived anybody.
Yeah.
It's that email and that tone that I think is really terrible.
It's...
They had a lot of It's a really long email. One section of it was on the reactions to the project, and you know, they're like, yeah, a lot of people hated us, but some people actually, you know, gave us positive reaction, saying many people encouraged us to keep pushing for modernizing the process of adoption despite criticisms of the interface itself in order to find better solutions. So they're saying that even people within the adoption community who, you know, actually saw it as beneficial told them to keep looking into something similar, but not a swipe style UI. So, I don't know. It stinks.
Well, and how did they make the world a better place? And
they
didn't. So they lampooned what they think the tech industry is, but what did they really accomplish other than pissing us off? What did they accomplish? What point did they make, and how did they make the world a better place through that?
I mean, unless because of this, people are going to stop making swipe interfaces.
Do they make me think about how terrible the tech industry is, or do they make me think about what assholes they are?
The latter.
Yeah,
I thought about both. I mean, I do think that there's a lot of...
I didn't need them to make me think that the tech industry is terrible, though. Like, it's not like they were shining a light on something that we didn't recognize or didn't all know. Like, if you pay at all attention to the... We have Silicon Valley. Like, have you seen Silicon Valley? It does everything you're claiming to try and do, but better.
I also feel in this climate, and with everything that's going on... How can you delight in creating what you know to be fake news and then lying when people ask critical questions? This is not the time of there. I mean, I don't think fake news has ever been helpful, but really this is not the time to make that your hobby. Creating and disseminating fake news. Find a more useful, productive job.
Can we ban the phrase fake news, by the way?
This was fake news.
Yeah, no, I mean, I get it.
I would love to stop hearing it.
It is one of those things. I'm just like, at this point, it's a phrase.
It's like when Internet of Things started coming up.
Makes me twitch. Okay, yeah, it's in the same thing.
But, I mean, just to wrap it up, I think I agree with Dana that, you know, if it is the timing of it and the intention and the denying of the fact. When we did our jobs as reporters to ask you and verify the facts, if it was true, short of really digging into your company documents, the fact that they said no and lied, that's where it crossed the line for me. So even though I don't want to lose a point, I would not disagree if you gave the point to Dana.
Yeah. Also, I mean, it's just abundantly clear that these are two people, the guys behind this, who just have, like, no sense of humor whatsoever. Well, I shouldn't say that. They have a terrible sense of humor. I mean, their previous project was Pooper, which was supposed to be Uber for dog shit. That's how it marketed itself. Yep. Like, it's not funny. It's not satire. It's just dumb.
Gross.
Yeah.
I would love to see them turn their energy or attention on something more productive. I feel like they would be able to do something more useful.
I would prefer they just disappear.
I like to have hope in humanity. I know it doesn't seem that way sometimes.
What's that? They remind me of those guys. What's that Judd Apatow movie, Knocked Up, where all the Seth Rogen's stone dude bro friends are trying to make this website that just shows the nude scenes in movies? Yeah, these are like his like stone loser dude bro friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's an insult to actual stone people. I know lots of lovely stone people.
Yeah.
But no, these are just useless dude bros.
Yeah. No, it's terrible.
I think we'll... Yeah, we know the answer to this.
No, nobody gets a point.
Nobody wins. Oh, yay, so it's a tie.
It's a tie.
Yay.
Yay.
So, yeah, fuck Adoptly.
Sorry, guys.
Let's move on, though, to group chat, our big talk of the week, which once again is going to be about Donald Trump, which is, I feel like, going to happen quite a lot over the next several years.
Hopefully.
Until I get fired, presumably.
Hopefully with more Arnold Schwarzenegger, though, in the coming weeks. That would make me happy.
Yeah. So I really, honestly, I really did this week want to get away from it, but there's just no avoiding it.
I know. I did want to. When I proposed it to you as a topic, I was like, I'm not feeling it, but we kind of have to.
We have to. So this last weekend.
Yes.
Donald Trump signed an executive order barring new refugees from the country and shutting down, at least temporarily, immigration from seven majority Muslim nations. We're not going to talk about that as a broader topic. I think people probably have an inkling as to what our personal opinions are about it. But I did want to talk about the tech industry's reaction to it. So one of the first to come out against it, though, was Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg, correct?
Yeah, in a decidedly more neutral way than a lot of other companies. I think Sundar Pichai from Google came out, or at least was reported to have sent a memo to his employees asking them to come back as soon as possible. And a lot of, I mean, Lyft's donation to the ACLU came pretty quickly. It wasn't one of the first, but it was definitely a strong stance versus what Zuckerberg said, which was, I mean, I don't remember the exact words, but I remember they were very neutral sounding.
So I have Zuckerberg's statement in front of me.
Okay.
And he definitely wasn't as aggressive as some others, but he also was pretty transparent about what his opinion was, and I think made it personal
mm-hmm.
in a way that I think is relatively effective. You know, I'll just read the
mm-hmm.
opening part of it. I won't, because it's a very long statement. Well, not very long, but relatively long statement. But he leads off by talking about how his great-grandparents came from Germany and Austria and Poland, and that Priscilla's parents, his wife, were refugees from China and Vietnam. And, you know, talking about how the United States is a nation of immigrants and we should be proud and all of this stuff. So, I mean, he personalizes it and humanizes it, which is nice. But he does stop a little bit shy of some of the other
yeah.
companies.
Whereas, I mean, I think Tim Cook has wondered aloud in interviews if there's room for legal action, which is a much stronger stance. But I think we should backtrack a bit just to underscore for people why this is actually a tech issue.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And not just a straight up political story.
Well, I mean, as someone who feels very impacted by all of this, I consider myself someone who works in the tech industry, and I'm a visa holder. So for, you know, one of the things that I was reading over the weekend that really frightened me was that, you know, people from those seven countries at the moment who had H-1B visas that's similar to the visa I'm holding basically weren't being allowed through the borders at all, whereas green card holders, whom you would think decidedly were more safe, right, it was just unclear if they were going to be able mm-hmm. to let go through at all. So that to me and to many other workers in tech like myself, that's a huge concern. And not just the people who are visa holders, but your coworkers and you guys, right? You would be affected too. If I was held at the border, you know, like you wouldn't have any reviews to, well, you would have fewer reviews
and,
to edit.
You know, you take a bigger company like Apple,
yeah.
Really had to scramble over the weekend to look after hundreds in some cases of employees who
yeah.
were abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, their ability to come back was sort of in jeopardy.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's sort of the thing, I think, is A, the tech industry is heavily reliant on immigrants, more so than a lot of other industries, and a lot of that has to do with America's failing to train enough engineers and computer scientists and stuff like that, and so we need to import people to do those jobs. And then the other part is that it's an industry that is very global
yeah.
and, you know, requires a lot of traveling and moving people about from country to country, and this kind of throws a wrench in things, right?
Yeah, and the nature of the internet, like you said, it's global. It's you can't avoid the fact that you're going to have to work with people from every country, and I don't see how shutting down your borders or preventing people from other countries from working in your country is going to help you internationally with your relationships with other countries at all. One of the things that came out early this week was rumors that another immigration order or bill was being considered that would increase the minimum wage of the H-1B visa, which, again, the tech industry is heavily reliant on,
mm-hmm.
to a minimum of about $100,000 or $130,000. So there's different bills being passed
mm-hmm.
around. One's from a congresswoman, Lofgren, and that one's the one that proposes $100,000 as a minimum wage. And that...
What's,
I mean,
the minimum currently on the H-1B?
It's prevailing wage for the industry, so that changes depending
okay.
on the year, and it's closer to 60,000.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what this is looking to do, what this bill would be looking to do then, is set like just a hard baseline.
For yeah. Right, and in Sherlyn's case, she would be held to the same standard as a software developer, and
right.
which isn't fair because software developers, as many of you might imagine, make more money than us
yeah.
news people.
Yeah. And this also kind of limits it to companies that are able to afford to pay people that much, right? So smaller startups who can't afford that much probably can hire anyone on an H-1B.
Mm-hmm.
Which is unfortunate because, you know, it's not that Americans can't do the job altogether, but for me, I've studied computer science since I was, 12, 13, like in school.
Mm-hmm.
That's just because Singapore loves computers for some reason. And
for some reason,
for
they're
some
okay.
reason. Yeah, they're all right. All right. But I've been, like, you know, designing websites. I've learned code since I was basically a child. So, I mean, I'm familiar with all of this stuff. I'm not a full-time programmer. I could be if I wanted to, but not go into that.
Yeah, a little humble brag in there. I could code if I wanted to.
Yeah, but my idea of the American education system, even today, doesn't have that kind of an emphasis on, you know, computer engineering,
yeah.
which is what the industry sorely needs.
Yeah. I mean, it's something that other countries have done a much better job at prioritizing and
right.
training people to do. I mean, I think you're starting to see America slowly coming around about how important STEM education
yeah.
is, but we're a little bit late to the game.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, that's the issue is that we just don't have the people to fill these jobs. It's as much as, you know, the rhetoric might be about how it's immigrants coming and taking American jobs, but that's just not really how it works as a general rule.
And I mean, there's obviously calls for training, right,
yeah.
to impart skills to people who might want these jobs, but that takes time. And meanwhile, you need people to fill these jobs or you're going to fall behind other countries.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of other countries other than the ones that immediately spring to mind that are, you know, that are going to take over really quickly in terms of, you know, cyber competition anyway.
Yeah. And I mean, and the other thing to think about there is often these jobs are concentrated in certain areas. You know, obviously a lot of the software development jobs, a lot of these coding jobs are all focused in the Bay Area or they're focused in New York.
Mm.
And getting somebody to move there is also problematic.
True.
Like, if you were born and raised in Cincinnati, Ohio, you might not want to leave Cincinnati, Ohio just to take a coding job. Whereas if you're somebody looking to move to America, you probably don't care. It's
right.
like, I'm taking a job no matter where it is.
Right. Like, I don't care where I live, really. Not, I don't really care. I mean, New York's fine.
New York's all right.
Yeah, it's okay.
It's okay.
It's all right.
Lies, it's the best. It's the best.
Okay.
You're with two native New Yorkers here.
I consider myself a New Yorker. There we go. Hey.
Yeah, but you're not native.
I'm not native. I don't
no.
care. Yeah.
You don't have his sweet Staten Island accent.
Thank God.
Which I did not know was a thing, by the way, that I had this.
I don't hear it either, but that's because I'm deaf in one ear now.
It's the way he says Staten Island, ironically.
I mean, that for sure. There's certain words. There's Staten Island.
Okay.
Because it turns into a single word.
There we go. The Staten Island Ferry? I don't know, whatever.
We are getting way off topic.
Yeah, we are. We're trying to, actually, it seems like. But, I mean, one last thing I will say is that, like, this already has a lot of immediate impact on certain countries, right? The
mm-hmm.
Just the proposed bill itself caused, like, the Indian IT industry to almost, like, to just suffer completely. Like, some of the big... So the reason the Indian IT industry is kind of concerned here is because a lot of these H-1B visas go to Indian IT workers, and, you know, it's about 70% of H-1B visas, which, and these are going to specific companies like big consultancy companies like Tata, which is a huge Indian company,
yeah.
Infosys. And so once that news spread that it was probably going to be harder for them to get those visas, their collective market value like tumbled $7 billion over in India. And that's just crazy. That's like huge losses
mm-hmm.
out of nowhere. And the Indian government apparently, their Ministry of Foreign Affairs has apparently said something to the Trump administration that they are concerned about this. I don't know that that's a strong enough stance, but, you know, at least they've said something. And I hope and expect more countries to come forward. I think Angela Merkel has said something strongly about this, but more about the refugee ban than anything else.
We're just making enemies everywhere.
Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. Might be a good idea for me to consider not trying so hard to stick around. Oh. I don't know.
No, we want you here.
Yeah.
I want to be here too.
You just have to be careful about what you say now.
I do. Can we get to that though? Like, I've been watching what I tweet.
Have you?
I have. I've been trying to be more sensitive. Like, I think Dana mentioned this earlier, or yesterday actually, that it kind of feels wrong.
So, I mean, we came in on Monday after this weekend of nonstop news, and, you know, people are making small talk, how was your weekend? I felt like I spent my whole weekend on Twitter. Not even tweeting and retweeting the whole time, though I was, but just that was my main news source.
Yeah.
And I found it really hard to step away, because what if I step away and go to sleep and news breaks overnight and I miss it?
I had a similar experience, yeah.
I've been staying up later each night. I have been doing less unwinding. I've been having more screen time. And so, and a lot have been on Twitter, actually. And we could talk about the reasons that Twitter seems really well suited.
Yeah.
It does seem ironic, though, right? Because Twitter is a company that has struggled to find its identity and find out how to make money off itself. And I still don't know the answer to that last part, but this is Twitter at its best.
Mm-hmm.
I think when people
flock
to it and well, at its most useful and most critical, where people flock to it and stick with it for hours because they see it as a primary news source, right?
Yeah.
How does Twitter take advantage of that and turn that into a business model?
I think Twitter needs to understand its user base really well, because this is an issue that really, you know, struck a chord with the people that use Twitter, people who are techie, people who are younger. Whether you're leftist or rightist, there's a lot of them on Twitter, and this issue really resonated with a lot of them. And immediately you have, you know, the hashtag method of collecting, you know, the news around this topic that really, I think, helped them a lot. And if Twitter understands how people are using it a bit more, they could strengthen their product. Hate that word, but hate the word product.
I mean, it's almost as bad as content.
It's almost as bad as content, yes.
I mean, I like you, Dana, have found myself kind of glued to Twitter more and more over the last several months. You, however, were saying yesterday that it's actually changed the way you use it.
Yeah, I mean, so at least in the past few days, I've started to feel, if I feel that I post too many non-political things at once or in a day, whatever that means, I start to feel guilty. So it's...
So you feel like you're not allowed to talk about things that aren't politics.
I worry that if I tweet too much about lighthearted stuff at a time like this, that I come off looking tone deaf or like I am not ambivalent. What's the word I'm looking for?
Not insensitive.
Complacent, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Complacent about what's going on, not worried. And I'm also, I mean, everyone's Twitter feeds are different, right? We all follow different people and have different people visible to us, but it does to an extent feel like we are all in a big room together where the tone is largely the same. And if everyone else is tweeting about politics, I think as humans we want to behave in a normative way and behave in a way that mirrors how our peers are behaving. So if other people are mostly tweeting nonstop about politics, I feel tempted, even without thinking about it, to follow suit. And when I do tweet about stuff that's silly, which I normally would have, I feel weird. I'm like, you know, do I look out of place and insensitive doing this?
I also, so that literally happened to me where I spent most of the weekend not paying attention to the news because it was Chinese New Year. And I was just calling my parents from here all the time. So when I really found out what happened was around Sunday late afternoon. And before that, I had posted a series of silly selfies and Chinese New Year related stuff that seemed very tone deaf. And that's when I kind of looked back and was like, holy crap, all this has been going on and I've been here posting selfies. And that really upset me, so I immediately had to like
it's
say something.
Because I think we're all our own worst critics in that sense. You know, I would have put two and two together and said, Chinese New Year is important to Sherlyn and she's celebrating it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have thought any more about it. But I think in that sense, we're all our worst critics of who we are on and off line.
Yeah.
I obsessively checked the timestamp of my selfie, and I was like, oh my gosh, when did the news break and when did I post this? And like, do I look like I was reacting to it? Like, it's just bad for me. And
but it's stressful. I mean, the news cycle right now is stressful enough, and the added stress of constantly curating your online persona on top of that is just enough to make someone want to take a social media break.
Which is probably
a healthy thing.
Yeah.
I more or less did that this weekend. I'm not going to lie. It was nice. It was good.
That's good.
It's good. Good.
Then
break.
You woke up to the horrors that unfolded.
Yeah. I spent most of Saturday not on the internet, and then like avoided it for most of Sunday as well.
But I feel like silence almost, I mean, it's something that's your right, and taking that break is, you know, something you should do. But, you know, remember how people were calling out Lin-Manuel for
Lin-Manuel
not saying
Miranda,
anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, people still expect public figures
The guy who called him out for that, though, is just a jerk.
I said for those at home, Lin-Manuel Miranda, the creator of the show Hamilton, which celebrates diversity.
Yeah, somebody called him out for not saying anything on Twitter.
Said something like, it speaks volumes that you're not
silence?
Hearing.
Yeah, like... Dude,
and it was a New York Times columnist.
It was.
I thought that was inappropriate on multiple levels.
Yeah,
it was a Saturday. I was with my family. Go fuck yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was inappropriate on a couple levels, right? I think a New York Times columnist should not be crossing that line, going that far. And I think Lin-Manuel Miranda in particular. I think people are right to wonder what he's thinking or saying, but I also don't think he has as much to prove.
Yeah, I mean, he's under no obligation.
Yep.
Like, if he wants to remain silent, that's his right.
You know, but I did understand why some people were eager to hear Sheryl Sandberg from Facebook say something about the Women's March a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, well, she is under more of an obligation, though, I feel like. Like, as a person...
Who does business with Peter Thiel.
Yeah. Like, there's...
And as a woman who other women look up to.
Mm. Yep. Like, these are all, like, obvious... areas where she has an impact, she has import, she has influence. It's not just about her personal opinion as a human, it's about what her position says about the position of Facebook as a company. It's about, and to an extent, she has the ear of people in the orbit of Donald Trump. Like, this is the sort of thing, like, her opinion matters more than Lin-Manuel Miranda.
I think that when people in positions of power speak out, that's, you know, that has more weight to, you know, people like Donald Trump or people in his administration who have to take that opinion or point of view more seriously because it comes from someone like Sheryl Sandberg or you know, everyone that signed the Tech NYC immigration disagreement. I forget what that's called. Petition? Yeah, so I think there are certain people where they should, and they're not obligated to.
That's not us.
That's not you and I. We should not feel like I don't. Well, I kind of.
We're
did.
Probably not going to get called out for being silent.
No one. No one's waiting.
Nobody cares.
Excitedly for me to say I do not like this. I oppose this. But I mean, though, if anyone else did feel like they would want to say it, I say go for it. I mean, the more people that speak out against it, the better, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. So the other thing I was thinking about when you guys talking is like, you were saying that you feel bad about tweeting all of this stuff that's not political.
And then, well, Facebook is a whole other story because most of my political activity is on Twitter, and I think there are a couple of reasons for that, right? My following on Twitter is about more than 10 times as big as on Facebook and includes a more diverse range of people, whereas in Facebook, to me, is a tiny little echo chamber.
Another little humble brag there, guys. Dana's got lots of Twitter
10
followers.
Times.
Or I just don't have many Facebook friends anymore. Facebook feels like a small echo chamber, and I think Facebook was designed with less built-in tolerance for repeat manic posting, right?
Yeah.
So I could retweet three things in 5 minutes on Twitter, and that won't look weird.
Yeah.
And it probably won't annoy people. It would on Facebook. So Facebook, in the first place, I feel that I need to be more selective. And the first thing I've cut on Facebook most of the time are news links, because oftentimes I have tons of other people in that same feed sharing the same links, right? So it just becomes information overload. Yeah, and I think in general, for other reasons, I post less on Facebook now. But what all that means is that as active as I've and vocal as I've been on Twitter, I look pretty damn silent on Facebook. So when I did post on Saturday night about a comedy show I went to, I immediately felt guilt. Like, this is the first thing I've posted about here on Days.
Yep.
In Days is this comedy show I went to. I regretted it afterwards. I think I probably looked pretty tone deaf, even though I know I'm very active on this other social network that I still believe is more conducive to political discourse than Facebook ever was.
I feel like Facebook's more personal, and that's the same. I mean, you even liked that status I posted after everything that I realized happened, and I felt like I had to explain myself on Facebook. Just be like, yeah, the reason I've been silent is because I only noticed it on Sunday afternoon. You know, I'm not, you know, oblivious to all of this. But you were saying something.
I've forgotten by now.
Something about...
When it's other people, I take some comfort in seeing happy moments from other people's lives. So, I mean, please do keep posting, if not Chinese New Year, your pets, your vacations with your kids.
Food. How about food pictures?
Food photos are cool, too.
Just keep reposting the Arthur theme as performed by Chance the Rapper, Jon Batiste, and Ziggy Marley. It's good times. It just
whatever floats your boat.
Yeah, I mean that's how I've made my week more tolerable. Is I've just played that on.
I've just been looking at cute puppies on Instagram.
Also a good one.
Nonstop. It's the
I
only
just look
way.
At my dog and my cats and then just go, "You're adorable. You're good.
Well, good for you. Good for you."
It's like having my own Instagram feed in my home.
What do you look at, Dana? Pictures of running. Pictures of people
she just
running.
Looks at marathoners.
No, actually, home decorating porn is kind of my jam right now. And so is HGTV. So while I'm on Twitter obsessively staying up, I have HGTV on in the background in a very poor attempt to keep me calm.
If it helps, you know. I watched Shark Tank to take my mind off it, and then I was reminded why America is kind of cool sometimes.
Because of Shark Tank?
Shh, you got the American dream.
Sure, okay.
It's over and over again.
I've literally never watched the show, so...
I watch anything that's business related on reality TV.
Shark Tank, isn't that from Mark Burnett, the same guy who probably has tapes of Trump that he never released?
Oh, the guy that released that other, or the one that was recording that other tape that was about grabbing.
Yeah.
Yeah. He probably does.
I like that you censored yourself there, as if like you're usually demure and wouldn't
People
say it.
People don't know me like you guys do. No, everyone does.
Yeah.
Everyone knows I'm crass. But I another thing about Twitter, though, is that, like, later in the week, it surfaced that the Trump administration or something was considering making your social media information part of the information you have to disclose at the border. And that, to me, was one of the reasons I started censoring myself on Twitter as well.
Which is a shame because, I mean, really, your First Amendment rights
is the most American.
Post about cats and whatever you post about on Twitter.
Yeah, but I also, like, now I'm so careful to look at whether I'm posting anything that looks un-American. I'm like, oh, what if I share this thing about China?
I mean, none of us are going to go on Twitter and say, we think Donald Trump should be shot.
Right.
You can't do that.
No one. Yeah, I'm not doing that.
I may have suggested we play in traffic at some point.
And even that, I mean, I think there's a discussion there about how far can you go and still be in your First Amendment rights on public social media.
To be clear, this was before he was president, so leave me alone.
but, I mean, barring even gray area stuff like that, the border agents should not be looking at your...
Yeah.
Using that as a criterion for letting you into...
That's just strange. But I was like, let's post more America things. So y'all will be seeing all of that.
You're just going to post photos of American flags for the next, like, every hour on the hour for the next 4 years.
Barbecues and, like, you know, American flag.
I'm going to get you a cowboy hat.
Yeah, I probably have one of those.
You probably have one already?
I also have American flag leggings. They're beautiful. I will be wearing them indefinitely to work.
We need to have another podcast discussion that's actually an intervention about Sherlyn's online shopping habit. And you.
What do I need an intervention for?
You showed up to work the other day forgetting that you had signed up for a Sierra Club membership.
Oh, yeah. This is, yeah.
He mentioned a Sierra Club before, but he impulse bought a Sierra Club membership and forgot about it.
Well, I impulse donated to them and got a membership card.
Oh, yeah, that's what you just said. Okay.
And I was like, I don't remember
doing
this.
Well, we also need an intervention for V. So it could be a whole intervention episode.
Yeah, I don't think I need an intervention for, like, making small donations to people. Like, that's fine.
It's just, I mean, it's just funny that some of us have an online shopping habit where we wake up the next morning and are like, oh, I have a cast iron skillet now. And you're like, oh, I have a Sierra Club membership.
Yeah.
That's a silly thing to impulse buy. Yeah.
I like our environment.
That's what my boxes from Amazon contain. Yeah.
Cast iron skillets.
Yes.
It's part of your New Year's resolution. I support it.
More frittatas.
There we go.
Yeah, there you go. I think that's a solid place to end the episode.
Yeah, more frittatas.
Sherlyn, you have anything to add? Any last thoughts before we go?
I will be... I can't.
No?
Okay. I can't.
Where can fine people find you on the interwebs?
If you're the Border Patrol?
Nowhere.
I don't care. No, at Sherlyn Lowe on Twitter. I don't care. They can have it.
Dana?
I am Dana Wallman on Twitter.
I am at Terrence O'Brien. Lots of E's, no A's. Just wanted to throw back real quick. If you haven't donated to the ACLU, you should do so because they can always use more money. So that's always a nice thing to do. And, you know, tax season is coming up, so, you know, you can write off that stuff. It might be a little bit too late
for
this year.
Not for this year.
ACLU is not tax deductible.
It's not?
No.
Right.
I've tried to do that in previous...
It doesn't... if you believe in the cause, you should still donate. Just don't donate because you think you'll get a tax benefit.
I was unaware that they are not tax deductible.
They were when I first signed up, but maybe it's changed.
While we're on this, I'm going to find out. ACLU...
Tax deductible. It's a very good way to end the podcast.
Wouldn't it be funny if I just gave you an alternative?
Gifts to the ACLU Foundation are fully tax deductible to the donor.
All right, boom. Well, for more fake alternative facts, Wallman, you can find me at Dana Wallman on Twitter.
I prefer alternative snacks, but...
I do, too.
I like that.
Yeah. Where were we going? We were ending the show.
Yes.
So, yeah, go donate to the ACLU. It's a great cause. They can use your money. Obviously, also subscribe to our show on iTunes or whatever your podcast app of choice.
We could use
your listenership and your reviews and ratings and all of that stuff. If you have questions, feedback, comments, all of that stuff, if you just want to send me hate mail.
Tell us about your favorite alternative snacks.
Yes, tell us about your favorite alternative snacks,
please.
And Dana
will make them.
# alternative snacks.
Yeah.
You can hit us up at Engadget Podcast on Twitter. You can also email us podcast@engadget.com. That's pretty much it. Thank you for tuning in. Make sure to tune in next week. But before we go, I want to leave you with a comment of the week, which comes from TechGuy25. He says simply, wow, that's sad.